Think big. Think positive. Never show any sign of weakness. Always go for the throat. Buy low, sell high. Fear, that's the other guy's problem. Nothing you have ever experienced can prepare you for the unbridled carnage you're about to witness. Right. Super Bowl, the World Series, they don't know what pressure is. In this building, it's either kill or be killed. Right. You make no friends in the pits and you take no prisoners.
No prisoners.
1 minute, you're up half a million in soybeans, and the next, boom, your kids don't go to college and they've repossessed your Bentley. Are you with me?
Hello and welcome to Turner's Take Podcast. I'm your host, Craig Turner, author of Turner's Take Newsletter. I'm a senior risk management consultant here at StoneX. I work with farmers, producers, and consumers, spec and hedge traders, and futures and options, OTC. We also do cash consulting for our producers and consumers also. If you have any questions about what I do or how I work with clients, please give me a call at 312-706-7610, 312-706-7610, or you can shoot me an email at craig.turner@stonex.com. If you are a client and you like what you hear here, or we need to make some changes or adjustments, please give me a call on my cell phone or by email. If you like the podcast, please go to iTunes and give us a positive review. And if you want to check out the newsletter, go to turnerstake.com. So I've been out of the office the week between Christmas and New Year's with the family, and that was fun down in Florida. And then in this past week, I was down in Kansas City for the FarmCon conference with Kevin Van Trump, and that was very interesting. We're going to go over some things from that conference and also just from other markets this past week and what we're looking for next week. So just diving into the macro first, I thought the big story was the Fed minutes were released from their December meeting. The market was a little bit caught off guard, I think, on just how hawkish the central bankers were at the Federal Reserve. You take a look at those minutes, and they talked about interest rate hikes. That was no surprise. They talked about tapering. I don't think that was a surprise. They did talk about what I thought was somewhat aggressively reducing the total assets of the balance sheet on the Fed. And I think that is what caught the market off guard a little bit, just how hawkish the Fed wanted to get. So, you know, when I think about the Federal Reserve and the last time they did this, it was back in 2014, I believe. And if we all remember, 2007, 2008 was the subprime crisis. And we went into zero rates and or almost zero rates and quantitative easing. And that went on for a long time, buying back, you know, the Fed buying securities, mortgage-backed securities, and treasuries. So that is, and then in 2014, and the dollar index back then was in the 70s, I want to say the high 70s, the USDA started raising rates and tapering. And then the US dollar index went into the 80s and really lived in the 90s for a while because the Eurozone was still doing easing. The United States wasn't. We saw a big gain in the dollar. The dollar pretty much crashed during the subprime crisis because of all the printing. And I'm sure everyone remembers kind of the inflationary pressures on gold and silver back then. What is interesting this time around is, you know, back in the subprime crisis, I don't think we saw as much inflation as we do now. I'm not exactly sure what that is. And when the economists write books on this stuff, it'll be interesting to see the explanations on why back in, you know, in the subprime crisis, things did seem transitory, while now they're structural. Regardless, if the United States starts getting to this in 2012, I would just expect the dollar to be higher. And when you take a look at the Eurozone, they're still talking about quantitative easing. Their economy has not bounced back or has not been as strong as the United States. And remember, the Fed has a dual mandate. The Fed says their job is to keep unemployment low or employment strong, however you want to read that. And unemployment, the latest numbers, job numbers, were under 4% unemployment. I can't remember if it was 3.8 or 3.9. I know the actual total number of jobs is disappointing, but if enough people take themselves out of the workforce, the unemployment rate goes lower. It's nothing the Fed can do about that. So their primary focus for this year is probably going to be, I mean, I'm 99% sure it's going to be inflation. You know, you can always be wrong there, but I mean, just looking at the numbers and what they've got to do. So could be challenging for the stock market, should be bullish for the US dollar. going forward here. And that's really the main major macro takeaway. We'll see how these things play out. But after the Fed release notes, you would think that interest rates would go higher, notes and bonds would come lower, some real strength in the dollar. And when I was at the conference, I'll stick this in here, I did get some, you know, inflation questions. And there were some of some guys I've known for years, where, you know, farmers who've been coming up to the booth asking about gold and silver. And I'll just reiterate this point. You know, back in 2007 and 8, in that period during, you know, the subprime crisis and all the pumping of money and quantitative easing, there really was no cryptocurrency to put your money into. So a lot of that, those funds, that money flow went into gold and silver. And this time around, the big difference is it went into crypto. You know, crypto was the inflation hedge, the inflation trade. Commodities, definitely. But all that money, that a lot of the money that went into gold and silver 10 years ago, 10, 12, 13 years ago, just seems a good chunk of that went into crypto this time around. So just a little bit of a side note there. So let's dive into some of the other things that have been going on. South American weather has been a big deal. You know, StoneX Brazil, our Brazil office, slashed soybean production by 10 or 11 million metric tons. That's a big deal. I mean, 10, you know, that's, let's take a look here. Make the math easy. 10 times, you do bushels. So maybe that's 400 bushels of soybeans. 390 million bushels of soybeans lost in South America. General rule is half comes back to the United States. Maybe it's 100, maybe it's 200 million bushels that come back to the United States. We'd have to see. But if it did, you know, maybe ending stocks aren't in the high 300s. Maybe they're in the low 200s. There's not a lot of believers in that right now in the fundamental market. But if other agencies like I think it was Ag Resource, I want to say there's another farm group that I saw reporting, you know, analysis group that put in kind of similar numbers for the reduction of soybeans. So it'll be interesting to see what Informa says too on those things. But there are some pretty big major outlets that put those headlines out. There's like about five or six of them. And some, it seems like they're all lowering the estimates. So if that's the case, I don't know how aggressive the USDA will be next week. I believe CONAB comes out on Tuesday, and then the USDA is on Wednesday. I know the USDA is on Wednesday. Will they follow CONAB? Usually they lag behind on the South American production. I would think it would come down, but not nearly as much as how some of these private private forecasters have said. Remains to be seen, but it does seem like the soybean balance sheet gets a little bit tighter. I have heard some arguments that the yields go up a little bit, and some of the exports we've seen early on might not have been as bullish as some of the trade have thought. So you are getting this argument. What is interesting too is the meal and oil for soybeans. Every way, anytime you look at vegetable oil and soybean oil, it does look, if these mandates are going to be, you know, if the government enforces the mandates, there's going to be a ton of soybean oil demand. And I know the counter argument is like, well, we can't supply this much soybean oil. You know, there's no way we're ever going to get these mandates filled. You know, we said the same thing about corn in 2006, where there's no way we're going to, you know, go from 1 billion usage of soy of corn to 5 billion bushels for ethanol. But, you know, over the course of 4 or 5 years, we did get there. You know, we went from producing 11 billion bushels of corn to 15 billion bushels. The argument's going to be where these acres are going to come from. I mean, wheat is high and is trying to buy acres. Corn is high and trying to buy acres. Soybeans are high, trying to buy acres. Oats are high, trying to buy acres. I mean, the one thing that really hasn't followed is rice. You got to wonder if rice follows in a big way at some point. But, you know, and then also the specialty crops. Cotton is high and fighting for acres. And then a lot of those specialty crops throughout the country. You know, it's very interesting to see where prices are. And, you know, now you have this biodiesel mandate, and it has the potential to really transform the vegetable oil market. And this current administration is very much dedicated to alternative and clean energies. And this would be one of those roads. So I'm not saying it's right or wrong, or if it's not going to gum up the works along the way in some way, shape, or form. Just saying that, this is the way it is, and it looks like the way forward for this administration and the EPA. That's the case. Bean oil and canola oil. And in Europe, you've got the EU rapeseed and the pot and also European sunflower. And then out in Asia, you got palm oil, and it just seems supportive for all those vegetable oils. We've been, and the thing is, forget about the energy component. We've seen on average 3, almost 4% year on year since 2006 increase in global vegetable oil demand. Even in the pandemic year, we saw a 2% increase in soybean in vegetable oil demand. I mean, during the drought years, it was 3 and 4%, even when we had the big shortages in 11, 12, and 13. So the demand is very inelastic. And now we're, now on top of that, we're putting these biodiesel mandates on. So it's a strange market. It's a strange dynamic that oil could lead soybeans. That's usually not the case. The old dynamic was meal led soybeans because meal can go rancid. Meal is the feed component, and then you would crush beans for the meal, and then if you could sell the oil now, great. You could store it for a while, right? Meanwhile, if you needed the oil, if you couldn't get rid of the meal, you wouldn't usually crush the bean. Dynamics are changing, and also I've been saying this before, and I still believe it. I think over the next couple of years, the United States gradually transitions from an exporter of soybeans to an exporter of meal, and we just crush all the beans here, keep the oil, and send the meal out. I know some people said, who's going to want to take this meal? Well, China takes all our soybeans and uses most of them for the crush. Same thing for Brazil. And they, in this, if they have to ship meal for feed, they have to ship meal for feed. You're already seeing China trying to get away from meal for feed. And, they're going to have to anyways if this, if this biodiesel mandates, come on online. I mean, and when you look at the production, something interesting I learned, or you got some concrete numbers finally when I was at the FarmCom, because you see numbers bantered around by the industry and analysts and reports, but it really seems like we can produce about 1 billion gallons of renewable biodiesel a year here. It's going to go up to 1.5 billion, and then 2 years, about 3 billion, based on all the current projects that we're having. So it's going to be interesting, how we do that, or billion barrels, I should say, not gallons. Go to 1.5 billion barrels, and then about 3 billion barrels in 2023. So we already use 40% of our soybean oil that we produce each year for biodiesel, and we're going to double and triple over the next couple of years. So you can start doing the math and see how tight things get. Going to be interesting. In terms of this week, though. Apparently, not only weather was rallying soybeans. I'm hearing, and I think we'll see reports of China buying more cargoes of soybeans, with the reasoning being they think that there could be production issues in Brazil also. So if they come and buy United States soybeans, they don't have to deal with the premium spikes in Brazil if the weather issues are real, right? So what happens sometimes in Brazil is you get these big spikes in the cash market, especially during the marketing year, and if China's buying them from the United States, then they can get more coverage from U.S. beans before we find out we have very big issues in the Brazil and Argentina crop. And if let's say the weather's really good and this is all like a regular weather market, and at the end of it, we have the same production and we didn't lose anything, cynical, but they can always cancel the US sales and then buy the cheaper South American stuff. That's how China operates. So I wouldn't be surprised to see more sales announced to China. We'll see, and they'll take them if the production destruction is real in South America. And if it's not, I'm sure they'll cancel some of those sales or switch the or orientation or however it works on that cash side. But I thought that was interesting, and that explains a lot of the soybean strength, not just being weather, but also being demand. you know, in case of real South American losses. So I thought it was very interesting. The corn numbers, you know, I was looking at corn here, and you know, one something we're going to dive into here over the next couple of months is, you know, ethanol is not just for car, you know, gasoline fuel anymore. You know, we're seeing it in sustainable aviation fuel. There are other applications. There are a lot of people in the ethanol industry that are at the FarmCom conference in Kansas City. And there are a lot of new applications, and these ethanol plants are finding the applications. So they're not 100% or a majority tied to and relying on renewable fuel standard. It is very interesting. Some of the, you know, the new applications for ethanol could more than make up for any kind of loss the ethanol industry might have from electric cars over the next 5 or 10 years. So I think we're going to hear more and more stories about that and more bullishness on ethanol. I mean, recently, I think the margins are about $1 in, you know, cents per gallon. So I would think the WASDE on Wednesday is strong on the ethanol number, which is, if we're going to get a little bit of a bullish surprise, personally think it would be in corn. You know, we're now talking some serious speculation here, right? But if I were going to guess on any kind of surprises, I guess I'd lean more bullish in corn and more bearish on beans, just because I think the market's getting ahead of itself compared to where the USDA and CONAB might be on the soybean supply situation. But we'll see. You know, the thing with the WASDE too, we got to remember there's a quarterly stocks report in there. And usually the soybean expectations on quarterly stocks are fairly on point. You can get some surprises. Where you can get some big surprises is corn and wheat. For example, you know, on the corn side, you know, it's the major three demand drivers are exports, which you get updated every week on, ethanol, we get updated every week on, and monthly, right, for both of those. And then feed, which we really don't hear about until once a quarter, feed and disappearance in the quarterly stocks. And wheat's the same. And, you know, the thing is, like, when you get these big misses, it's always on the feed side. You only get updated quarterly. And if something's going to just come out of left field, that's what it is. So that's something to pay attention to on Wednesday. And is there anything else? You know, for wheat, wheat's just been weak. If you take a look at a chart of wheat, especially Minneapolis wheat, you know, we were in these $10 range for about 3 months, and we needed to be to effectively price ration wheat. That's what the market does. You get to these very high levels, you hang out there for a while to either the crop is made, or, you know, in the case of wheat, we hung out in this $10 to $11 range until South American and Australian wheat is available on the export market. Now that it is, it's been able to make a leg lower, and it's going to test the 200-day moving average, it looks like. So it could be high eights and in the nines now in spring wheat. And, you know, maybe we stay in the 7s, 8s, and 9s in the spring wheat and the 6s, 7s, and 8s for winter wheat until we can get a North American harvest, right? Because as far as the global export market goes, a lot more wheat is produced in the northern hemisphere than the southern hemisphere. And we will see winter wheat seedings acres on Wednesday. So that's going to be playing a big, I think will play a big part into this. We have seen the wheat get weaker, because more of wheat is available in the southern hemisphere. There has been an argument saying the economists have been saying, when you take a look at the price of wheat and the inputs and the availability of the inputs, it makes the case for more wheat acres. You take a look at the insurance data, and it's preliminary, but you look at some of the insurance data coming out about who's insuring wheat acres, and it's lower than expected. What is, you know, and early on though, what does that mean? We're going to find out on Wednesday what that means, but that could be a wild card too. So, you know, the January WASDE can be a very big report. You don't want to hold a lot of risk into it, whether you're a farmer on the cash side, whether you're a producer, or you were their consumer, or if you're spec trading. I think the biggest risk, because prices are so high, are for the producers who are unhedged. It's also for the speculators who are long, right? While probably those who have less to lose would be those who are short, though I wouldn't want to – never love being short going into these major reports. I'd rather be in puts. And then the commercial side of it, right? You know, the end users who have to buy this, who are probably buying in shorter time frames, you know, just waiting for the prices to eventually come down. With that in mind, I'm going to wrap up with this. I had another topic we're going to follow here going forward is when corn, wheat, and soybeans and the other commodity markets, major commodity markets, get back into a, let's just call it a historical normal supply and demand. I mean, historically, corn, when it's adequate, is about a 2 billion carryout or around like this 13 to 14% stocks usage. Soybeans, you know, in this 400 million, you know, where you're getting close to 10% stocks usage. When we get back down there, and it will happen eventually, I don't know if it's this year, next year, could be 2 years from now, but eventually the acres in production catches up to demand, you know, at some point. Whenever that happens, are the old lows of pre-pandemic the same as the lows that will be post-pandemic and this inflation that we've seen? Because it's not just transitory. If inflation was 100% transitory, like the Fed was saying, then if we went back to a 2.2 billion carryout in corn and our stock to usage was like 14%, then I'd be, you know, on my podcast, on the podcast, and, you know, when I do my speaking gigs and when I write the newsletter, I'd be like, yep, harvest lows, potentials 330 to 340. That's what it's been. That is what it's been since, I don't know, 2014 through 2019. If we're going to have a 2.2 billion carryout in corn, we're looking at the low to mid threes harvest, you know, harvest lows in the futures. If we get to 2.5 billion or more, you know, who knows? We could touch three or get real low, like 310 or something like that. You know, if we're going to be, you know, tight, like 1.5, you know, we're just going to be in the mid to high threes. If we're going to be 1.2 or 1 billion, you know, we're really going to be just above four across the board, right? Just rationing the whole marketing year. But what now? You know, and if we have real, let's say for the past 2 years, we had 5% inflation, you know, our harvest lows on adequate to burdensome stocks aren't 330 to 340 anymore. They would be 365, 370. 360 to 370. If it's 10%, no, I'm sorry, if it was 5%, it'd be closer to like 350, 360. And if it was 10% inflation, we'd be closer to 370, 375 for harvest lows. And also, well, if inflation doesn't stop right now, what if we have another year of inflation and it takes the Fed another year to get things really under control? Like they do the tapering and the interest rates and they reduce the balance sheet. What if, you know, between the start of the pandemic and the next year or two, you know, inflation is real like 10 or 15%, right? Over the, not per year, but over the course of those 3 years, right? You know, you can make the case that the new lows for corn, let's say 2 years from now, we get back to normal supply and demand, 2 or 3 years, you know, is our 2 billion, 2.1, 2.2 billion target, you know, for a price at harvest in the high threes, low fours. You know, for soybeans, is it go into the nines and tens if that's the case? Because $4 times 2.3 is 920. So is all of a sudden, you know, are these the harvest lows where, you know, corn spends most of its time in the fours and maybe it dips below four during harvest and soybeans are usually around the tens, but maybe we make that run down into the nines during harvest? Adequate to burdensome years? It's a very interesting question. And we're not going to know until, I mean, we're not going to know this year. I don't think so anyways. You know, with this marketing year, maybe next marketing year, if you get a lot of acres and everything goes great and you bring acres out across the world and everyone has a good growing season, then we start to see where this is. But I don't think we'll be at the lows that we saw on 14 through 19 when we had big, big crops. Time will tell, but I just don't think it. So the reason when I say this is, you know, we have to question now on new crop, what are good prices for 22 and 23, right? If we do have big crops, and I think that's something we'll be talking about going forward too. So hope everyone had a good week, first week of the year. I will sign it off now. If I saw you down in Kansas City, had a great time. I'm not traveling again until probably March. I will be at Commodity Classic, probably be in Canada a little bit in March too, but I am going to be in Chicago for the rest of January and February. If anyone needs anything, please give me a call. Contact me anytime. My number is 312-706-7610. You can follow me on Twitter. I'm going to try to get – it's a New Year's resolution. I'm going to try to get a little bit more active on Twitter and of course, the newsletter and the podcast. I hope everyone has a great weekend, and I'll talk to you next week.
This material is conveyed as a solicitation for entering into a derivatives transaction. This material has been prepared by a Daniels Trading Broker who provides research market commentary and trade recommendations as part of his or her solicitation for accounts and solicitation for trades. Daniels Trading, its principals, brokers, and employees may trade in derivatives for their own accounts or for the accounts of others. Due to various factors such as risk tolerance, margin requirements, trading objectives, short-term versus long-term strategies, technical versus fundamental market analysis, and other factors, such trading may result in the initiation or liquidation of positions that are different from or contrary to the opinions and recommendations contained therein. Past performance is not necessarily indicative of future performance. The risk of loss in trading futures contracts or commodity options can be substantial, and therefore investors should understand the risks involved in taking leveraged positions and must assume responsibility for the risks associated with such investments and for their results. You should carefully consider whether such trading is suitable for you in light of your circumstances and financial resources. You should read the risk disclosure accessed at www.danielstrading.com. Daniels Trading is not affiliated with, nor does it endorse any trading system, newsletter, or similar service. Daniels Trading does not guarantee or verify any performance claims made by such systems or services.